He shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So let's recall where we've been in Daniel 11. Remember, we have the Greek kingdom divided into pieces, and these two pieces in particular are fighting against each other. The northern kingdom, the king of the north and the king of the south, that is Egypt in the south, and the Syrian Empire and Babylonian Empire up here in the north. These two are fighting with each other during the time that's a lot in the time between our Old Testament and New Testament is when a lot of this takes place. And they are always fighting with each other, it seems. And Israel and Jerusalem in particular is being caught in the crossfire and being severely affected as time goes on. Now, just a reminder, all of the rulers in the south had the same name. They just had a different number after them. They were all Ptolemies, Ptolemy something, the second, third, fourth, and so on. And up in this kingdom, the Syrian kingdom here, the names were almost always one of two, Antiochus or Seleucus, and then they had numbers as well. But so it's not that hard to remember them. You just have to remember the numbers. All right. We remember that there was a point where the king of the north sent his daughter down to the king of the south to marry, and the king of the north's daughter's name was Cleopatra, a predecessor to the famous Cleopatra, and then down in Egypt, where it was a very young king, Ptolemy, a very young Ptolemy down there, the Ptolemy the Fifth. So the idea was that the daughter of Antiochus the Great in the north would sway, at least this was Antiochus's plan, sway the king of the south to become a kind of a follower of his ways. And in fact, that did not happen. And the daughter, Cleopatra, that went down actually encouraged Ptolemy to align with the up-and-coming Rome. Now, when Alexander the Great conquered and created the giant Greek Empire, Rome was not to be even thought of. It was not to be considered. It wasn't a... nobody gave it a second thought. But as time goes on now, Rome is... it's becoming more and more clear that they are going to be the superpower. And Cleopatra sees this, and she encourages Ptolemy to align himself with Rome. This is going to become important. Because as we move along, and we did this last time, Antiochus the Fourth, this is the real bad guy. This is the guy that is the most notorious, most infamous for what he did to Jerusalem. When he comes to power, this is going to become important that Egypt has aligned with Rome. So Antiochus the Fourth is now the king up in this north part. Ptolemy the Sixth is now the king in the southern part. And we remember Antiochus in the north, he got his in by intrigue, as the verse says in Daniel. He did not, or by flattery, as some translations have it. In other words, he got there using his mouth. He was not actually the heir, but he went in and he said, "Oh, don't mind me, folks. It's my brother who's the heir. I understand that, but he's in prison for the moment. I'm just a placeholder here, a caretaker of things until he gets out. Don't mind me." And people kind of let him be there, and he slowly, but surely, or not slowly, but a little at a time, gathered a support around himself. And eventually he got some loyal followers. He used money to get some loyalty from others by way of bribery. And eventually he had gained critical mass, as you would say, and then he couldn't be stopped. So the mask came off and he said, "Forget it, I'm the one ruling here. Forget about my brother." So Any resistance to his rule was easily swept away. This was the kind of guy he was. Once he had that group of close supporters, he revealed himself as the ruler. Now, while he was ruling, Jason kind of understands. Jason's name was Joshua. He was in Jerusalem. He was brother of a guy named Onias, and we mentioned this last time, who was high priest. They were both descendants of Aaron. So Onias was actually the high priest. And he says, he goes to Antiochus, said, "Hey, I tell you what, if you get rid of Onias and put me in as the high priest, I'll make sure that Jerusalem gets Hellenized, that is Greekized, and I'll bring the Greek ways in because I know that's your plan anyway, and I'll make sure that Jerusalem sends you more money than they are now." So Antiochus likes the idea. He kicks out Onias and he installs Jason. And this is not the gymnasium, but one of the an example of a gymnasium that was installed not too far from the temple itself. And the Greek gymnos means naked, and that's actually part of the games that would take place. So it's very pagan, very much of an affront to the Jewish religion and the Jewish Old Testament that they are following or seeking to follow. So Jason does a good job of transforming Jerusalem into a Hellenistic city until Menelaus sees what Jason did, and he goes to Antiochus and says, "If you put me in as high priest, I'll do better than Jason. I'll make Jerusalem even more Hellenized, and I'll give you even more money." And Antiochus actually agrees to that. So now Menelaus is appointed as high priest, but what's important about this is Menelaus is not a descendant of Aaron. So now for the first time, the office of high priest is now just a political office and not legitimate office that was prescribed in the scriptures and by God. And Onias, well, he objects to this, but as you could guess, he's executed. So things are going bad enough in Israel that Israel calls down to Ptolemy the VI, says, "Hey, we're really getting it pretty rough from Antiochus up here. Can you help us?" So Ptolemy actually agrees and starts to move a little bit in toward Jerusalem, and not in a way that should have stirred up a lot, but it ends up stirring up a whole lot. Antiochus comes back with a very hard hit. Now, we're going to see this guy, Ptolemy the VI, can't catch a break anywhere. So first of all, he tries to do something good and give some relief to the people of Israel, and he ends up being, you know, met and spanked by Antiochus coming from the north in a strong way to what he's trying to do. But also, his closest advisors turn against him. And this ends up, you know, just as the scripture said, this ends up really hurting him. Ptolemy's army surrenders. Ptolemy's reduced to a puppet leader under Antiochus's direction. Well, when I said he can't catch a break, it doesn't end there. The city of Alexandria appoints Ptolemy the VIII as their leader because they don't want a puppet regime. In other words, Ptolemy the VI, he can't even succeed as a puppet. And so this other guy named Physcon, Ptolemy the VIII, called the Fat, he is in Alexandria. So I told you this: he can't catch a break. Well, in fact, he did catch one break, and it was a big one. And that is, his father is the one who aligned himself with Rome and came under a treaty agreement with Rome. That is, when people attack Egypt, it's like they're attacking Rome. And he comes and he goes to Rome and appeals for help. Physcon drives out Ptolemy. So Physcon is not only in Alexandria, he's driven him out completely. So this poor guy, Ptolemy the Sixth, is just getting beaten left and right. But he goes to Rome, and this is the key. His father had the alliance with Rome due to Cleopatra's influence. He now appeals to Rome and says, I need your help. And Rome listens because they have signed a treaty. So Antiochus this time, and this is what we read, he shall return, that is, Antiochus Epiphanes is going to return now that he's geared up. He's really going to let the South have it. But it shall not be like the former. In other words, the last time he had great success, but it's not going to be like that. It's not going to be like any time that he would ever go down. So he comes in 168 BC. He returns to Egypt ready for battle, but he doesn't realize what he's going to face when he gets there. But not like the former. See, now Rome has looked favorably to Ptolemy's request, and Antiochus ends up meeting a Roman senator along with a small band of people with him, nothing so impressive, certainly not as big as Antiochus's group. And this guy, his name is Gaius Papilius Laenas. Now, interestingly enough, Gaius, by the way, is a name in the Bible. Not him, he's not in the Bible, but this name is a name used in the Bible. You can find it, for instance, in 3 John, that his epistle is written to a guy named Gaius. So it was a name that was around at the time. But this guy is not even a military general. He's a senator. So if you look at our politicians today and look at them compared to what military leaders look like today, they don't really look like a rough or person you'd be afraid of. But it doesn't matter. Gaius goes to Antiochus Epiphanes, and they meet. Antiochus has his army with him, and Gaius is this little politician, shows up not in army clothes or anything like that, probably a toga or something, shows up with his little group of people behind him and tells Antiochus Epiphanes, here's how it's going to be. He's got a written document telling him what the terms are for Antiochus Epiphanes, and he better listen to those terms or he's got to fight Rome. So he gives Antiochus Epiphanes this ultimatum. Says, either you're at war with Rome, or you have to basically back off, agree to these terms, and we want you to behave. And so Antiochus, being a proud man, the proud leader that he is, he realizes he's kind of stuck. And so his answer to get away from this is, he says, well, let me talk to my counselors and so on, and I'll get with you in a day or two and give you an answer to your question, to your ultimatum. And it's at this point that this guy, little guy Gaius, with a stick in his hand, draws a line in the sand. He literally draws a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes and says, I don't think you understand. He said, if you don't give me an answer before you step out of that circle, your answer will be assumed to be a declaration of war on Rome, and we will respond appropriately. This is a picture of the scene. Here's Gaius. He's not dressed in any military outfit at all. He comes to Antiochus Epiphanes, and there's his line in the sand, and he's holding the document of terms and things like that. And Antiochus Epiphanes is completely humiliated. He can't do anything else because as proud as he is and as maybe confident as he is, he understands at this point that Rome has developed such a military might that it would be crazy to try to take them on. So humiliated, he agrees to the terms. And when he agrees to the terms, Gaius is like, all right, he shakes his hand and pretends to be friendly and everything like that. Well, this is, by the way, where that expression comes from, a line in the sand. And there's a term that people use called displacement, like a psychological term or something, displacement. Displacement is when something goes wrong at work, and instead of retaliating at work, you come home and kick the cat. That's displacement. You take your anger somewhere else. Well, this is what happened with Antiochus. He was so humiliated in this, but he knew he couldn't do anything because it would be taken as a declaration of war on Rome, that he furiously leaves the scene. And where does he have to pass through to get back home? But he's got to go back through Israel again. And that's where he takes out all of his aggressions. He didn't like Israel anyway. He didn't like the fact that they were holding on to the Hebrew scriptures and those ways. And even though there was a split in Israel and some of the people were Hellenized and some weren't, it still drove him crazy. And now he's furious about this. Now, the verse here says, "For ships from Cyprus shall come against him." This word Cyprus, in most Bibles, is translated Kittim, that is the lands from the west. And it is understood to be referring to the warships that Gaius came in on from Rome. Even though it says Cyprus here, most of the other translations say Kittim. And in fact, the Living Bible, which is a paraphrase, simply says Roman warships. So that's what that's referring to, is Gaius coming in on ships to that. Now, it says here, "He shall be grieved," that's what happened when he got humiliated, "and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage." So he's going to go back and really take it out on Jerusalem. "So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant." So he's going to basically say, if you want things good, you forsake your ways in Judaism. If you want things bad, you just keep right on going, and I'll see to it that they'll be bad. So what does he do? Well, he does several things. He gets into Jerusalem. First, he tears down lots of houses to build his own fortress just in case there's some invasion from the south. Then he goes to the temple, and one of the first things he decrees to the land is that in your mind there's no more Jehovah. There is only Zeus Olympus, and he now dedicates the temple to Zeus Olympus as opposed to Jehovah. He then says people must sacrifice pigs to Zeus. You can tell this is going to go along well with the scriptures that they've been given. You're no longer allowed to practice the Sabbath, your feasts, or your circumcision. You can't do any of this. And then there is the abomination of desolation, which is most understand to be the time when Antiochus offers a pig on the altar, the brazen altar at the temple. Now, I have often struggled with these choice of words, the abomination of desolation, in terms of what does it mean? Why is the word desolation chosen? How does that fit? And basically, the idea with desolation could even be translated desecration. And the way I make sense of it is it's desolation that comes as a result of desecration. So what Antiochus did was he desecrated the temple and thereby ended the temple practices. So people aren't going to be coming to the temple the next day to do some good things because it's now been desecrated. It is now desolate. So I think of the Chernobyl disaster, right? The Chernobyl disaster for a big chunk of land brought desecration. And that desecration brought desolation because nobody wants to live there. So that's how I understand these words. He plundered the temple treasury. Real great guy, let me tell you. And then after he finally did leave, he left troops there for what would be a reign of terror. In other words, if you're caught doing any of these things, you're going to be killed. And that's the what this verse is saying. Forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. So just following exactly what the scriptures are saying is what happens. So for these 3 years, 168 to 165, the temple is desecrated. It's out of service. That is, to the true God, it's out of service. It is shut down, essentially, for that time. Now, the next verse, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but people who know their God and shall be strong and carry out great exploits. This verse seems to imply that there's a division, and we've talked about the division before. There's a division between those who hold to the scriptural practices and those who align themselves with Antiochus Epiphanes and say, yeah, we like the Hellenization, we like what you're doing, or at least we don't mind it, and we're fine with it. And Israel really was divided. There was the Jewish Hellenists, the proto-Sadducees, that embraced the pagan worship, and the Hasidim, the proto-Pharisees, that heroically opposed the Syrian abuses, risking severe punishment. This kind of created this underground movement, secret worshipers, secret learners. You weren't even able to have the Hebrew Scriptures, so they tried to keep these underground. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. So they met underground. They tried to resist, but they were not very successful, at least at the beginning. And many people died in Israel in torturous ways. But the faithful teachers continued underground, and really tens of thousands were martyred for being faithful to the scriptures. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. This is likely talking about the Maccabean revolt. There is a little help that occurs in the midst of all of this persecution. But what about this next part of the verse? But many shall join with them by intrigue. And the idea is that the Maccabean revolt, which we'll talk about in a minute, provided a little help. But then when it looked like they were actually succeeding, a lot of people who were really just as Hellenistic as the worst of them kind of joined on and said, yeah, well, we'll join too. Verse 35, some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So what this time period did and this persecution did, it achieved a lasting core group of faithful people. And this is evidenced even when the Lord came to the earth, that you do find your Josephs and Marys and Annas and Simeons, and you find this core group of people that were faithful at that time. So in the few minutes, we'll talk a little bit about the Maccabean revolt and talk about what it is and what happened. So Antiochus the Epiphanes is ruling in the north. He launches this attack on Jerusalem. After he left his many military men there to ensure that this pagan these pagan practices would propagate outside of Jerusalem, and that nobody's going to turn back and go back to their old ways in Jerusalem. Well, this is fairly successful. These troops are scattering around to the far-off places trying to get people to ensure the pagan worship. And they come to a place called Modin, which is about 20 miles west or northwest of Jerusalem. And this little place, Modin, they come to demand pagan worship there, like they've been doing at a lot of places. And they come to a guy named Mattathias, who's the priest around there. Well, they say, yeah, so sacrifice this pig to Zeus, or whatever they're going to say. And this priest, Mattathias, who's about 80 years old, sees this compromised Jew. First of all, he says he's not going to do it. So this compromised Jew says, well, I'll do it, maybe trying to save his own skin. He tries to sacrifice to Zeus, and Mattathias, this 80-year-old man, gets his sword and kills the guy. And then the Syrian soldier that's there, he turns around and kills him too. He's a must have been an adrenaline rush in this guy Mattathias or something. He kills the Syrian soldier that was sent to force the idolatry. So after this, Mattathias calls for people to follow along in this. So this is a picture of what it might have been like when Mattathias is calling for followers. So he calls for followers, and even though the Syrian army is much stronger than the followers they have, they engage in kind of a guerrilla warfare kind of thing, where there are these sneak ambushes and sneak attacks, hit and run kind of things, where even though you're smaller than your enemy, you can still do a lot of damage to your enemy. And that's what they're doing against the Syrian forces. And this group became known as the Maccabees. Now, in 165, Mattathias will die, but his third son, Judas Maccabeus, leads the campaign. So the third son, Judas, leads the campaign. Actually, he started leading about a year before his father died. And he was an amazing tactician. Judas Maccabeus, which is a name meaning hammer, he has a series of surprising victories. Here's a picture of him. You know he's going to have a lot of victories. Look at that face. I mean, you know this guy is not going to mess around. And in 165, Judas Maccabeus retakes Jerusalem and, in fact, retakes the temple. An amazing time. In 3 years after the desecration by Antiochus Epiphanes, the temple is retaken and, in fact, rededicated to the Lord. And this would correspond to some of the things that we read about in Daniel. Now, this was such a glorious event in the eyes of Israel that they instituted an annual feast. Now, they knew it wasn't one of the seven annual feasts in Leviticus 23, but they added this annual feast as just a separate one, and that is called the Feast of Dedication, or the Feast of Rededication, commemorating the event that this temple was rededicated to the Lord 3 years after its desecration. Now, in its rededication, they needed 8 days' worth of consecrated oil for the lamp that they didn't have, but they went ahead and started it anyway. And then you can decide for yourself whether you think a miracle happened or whether it's not a miracle or what happened. But the oil that they put in did last for all 8 days of this feast of rededication. So this feast would be either called the Feast of Dedication or the Festival of Lights. Lights because of this... by the way, this number of lights does not match the lampstand in the temple. It was the lampstand in the temple that they had to light. But this number of lights represents the 8 days, four on each side of that center one. So it was the Festival of Lights or the Feast of Dedication or the Feast of Rededication is really what it was. Now, in John chapter 10, it says that the Lord Jesus went to the Feast of Dedication. So Hanukkah was being celebrated at the time the Lord walked the earth, and the Lord went to it, interestingly enough. So when we think of Hanukkah and the Jews that celebrate Hanukkah today, the problem is not so much that they're celebrating something bad. It's actually something good that they're celebrating. They're celebrating the fact that people that were faithful to the Lord and people that were faithful to His word cared about the temple and retook it and were able to rededicate it to the Lord after it had been desecrated. So it's not that the people, the Jews today, celebrating Hanukkah is so bad, as much as they aren't celebrating, they're deliberately not acknowledging the birth of their Messiah, the Lord. So the thing that's bad about Hanukkah is not so much in and of itself that it's a bad thing, as much as they're using it as the thing to push out a remembrance of the Lord Jesus, and they, of course, generally speaking, reject him. Judas continues to gather power and momentum in Israel, but Judas is ultra-conservative. He makes a lot of enemies because he is so hardcore. It's like he's implementing Sharia law kind of mentality. After Antiochus Epiphanes dies in his reign in the north, Demetrius, his brother, the one that should have been on the throne from the beginning, reigns in the north. Judas is so ultra-conservative that the liberal Jews request salvation from Judas. They're requesting salvation from Demetrius, from Judas. What these people are thinking, I don't know. But anyway, Judas ends up being killed, and his brother Jonathan gathers strength. Now, Jonathan is a lot more diplomatic. He's a lot more diplomatic, and this is important because Demetrius II, by this point, appoints Jonathan to be governor and high priest over Israel, and then Jonathan's brother Simon is appointed governor over some other territory there. And then when Jonathan dies, Simon is able to negotiate with Demetrius the independence of Israel. Israel was actually independent for about a century until they were claimed by the Romans in about the 60s or so BC. So they had almost a century of self-rule in what was called the Hasmonean dynasty, and it was established until the Romans took over in 63 BC. And that's actually how Israel reconstituted itself. You know, the northern kingdom, they were out when the Assyrian government took over, the Assyrians took over. And Judah was even broken into pieces to where there was just a little group around Jerusalem pretty much. But it was during this time where they had independence that they took over these lands again, and including Galilee, where the Lord Jesus would be raised. So when you look at a map of Bible times at the time of Christ, it looks just as big as it was in the Old Testament. That doesn't mean it was big the whole time. It was during this time period that they kind of rebuilt themselves. So with that, we'll end and turn things over.